This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, do I have two of the greatest historical writers in the world. They are so fantastic, and I am so thrilled to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Margaret George and Brooke Allen. Hi, girls. Oh, can I call you girls?
Hi. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear
yes.
me?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. We have a little, we have no air conditioning in the studio. This is going to be fun today. By the end of this, it's going to probably feel like a sauna in here. Whoa, how are you?
Well, you go.
Well, I'm fine.
I'm fine too. It's been a fun summer so far, although rather hot. We're up in Washington D.C. right now, so it's pretty hot here, but it's nice too. So,
well, you know, Margaret George, you are just, you know, I've had you on the program a number of times, and my listeners love you. I have one particular listener, Mickey, who just, she's just so crazy about your books, and she reads them, she's reread. Now, when we say we reread Margaret George, it is a big thing, because Henry VIII is how many pages?
I think it's like 900 pages.
Margaret.
30-something.
It is a... It is a big, big book. And the fact is, it is easy to read twice because you read it, you know, when it first came out back in, I can't believe it, it's 1986.
Yeah, it's soon going to be its 35th anniversary.
This is amazing. And it is still stands as one of the very, very best books about Henry VIII ever written. I love this book. You took a new look at Henry that other people hadn't, and it's so fresh. And I reread it. I read it originally because, I read, having lived in England and loving everything English, I just grabbed your book. I think probably I got it on the day that it came out because I used to do that. It was funny. In the old days, I had to actually buy books, and I don't have to buy books anymore. But then, of course, I reread it a few years ago, and it is still so fresh and so beautifully written.
Well, thank you. You know, I should reread it myself, because I often don't reread my own things. I can remember what it was like writing them. And I picked it up the other day, actually, to check on something, because there was someone who was studying her ancestor and wanted to know something about it. It's an obscure serving lady with Queen Catherine Howard. And, you know, I had to look and see what was my bibliography for that.
Oh.
She wanted to know some, and I started reading the section and, you know, did I say this or did I say that? So I really should reread it myself. And I might be surprised.
Well,
what's in there?
It is so good. Well, all of your books are so good, and the whole thing is, you know, it's so exciting when we look back at your writing career, because of course you started with Henry, just with the idea that you wanted his story told.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I think it's so nice when a character sort of comes to you. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah. Exactly. It certainly is, because I think, you know, you have to be drawn to it, and you have to, it has to be your idea, or else you just could not spend all those hours and years and so on in the person's company, you know, unless it was kind of your idea to get together to begin with.
Well, and you did. You had to spend a lot of years, especially since you wrote that book by hand.
I did. It's not, I can't believe that, but it's true.
I think that's so beautiful. When I tell people, you know, sometimes people will come to me, new people who say, oh, you know, I want to write a book, but I don't have a computer. And I say, yeah, okay. Shakespeare didn't, and neither did Margaret George.
That's right. Yeah. I remember I was terrified of the computer when my husband brought it home and said, well, you really have to learn how to use this. And, you know, it was like it was sitting there like a big monster, a very mysterious big monster. And I did not switch to writing on the computer until halfway through Mary Queen of Scots. Half of that's handwritten, too.
Isn't that funny? I mean, when you look back on it?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And, of course, well, Brooke, you know, Brooke Allen, you have this wonderful trilogy, Marcus Antonius, and you, of course, you wrote it on a computer. But the two of you, you know, between the two of you, because it is July and yesterday was Julius Caesar's birthday, I thought we'd talk a little bit about some of the research, because you both had to do research on Julius Caesar.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we did. Yeah, I was thinking about Julius Caesar yesterday. He's always convenient to remember because he was born conveniently at 100 B.C.
Yeah, I love that. It makes it real easy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I saw a lot of things on Facebook commemorating him yesterday.
Yeah. So, you know... And I was also talking last week. It was funny. I was talking to Leslie Carroll, and we were talking about Princess Di's statue, because she's of course a royal watcher, and she was there actually for the wedding of Harry and Meghan, and she covered that, and so she was of course very interested in the statue. And she feels, like I do, that statues can speak to you when you're doing research. In her case, of course, she did the Marie Antoinette series, and she really found life in the statue. So I was wondering, for you, when you were doing this research, do you have particular memories of looking at statues to help inspire you?
Well, I think so, you know, especially we have them of Caesar, but it was more like trying to track down ones of Cleopatra, because there's none that is absolutely attested as being Cleopatra. So you have these ones that people assume are Cleopatra, you know, there's not a handy little thing under it saying Cleopatra. So, and then, but Antony, there are more, isn't that right, Brooke? But not all of them are attested. People just assume that's him because it looks like the coin portraits. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the coin portraits are probably the best thing we have as far as likeness. But actually, I don't mean to negate you at all, but there are very few Antony portraits or portraits that are assumed to be him. And I was fortunate enough to see one at Centrale Montemartini Museum 2 years ago, and it was so exciting. I think definitely that was the one that spoke to me.
Well, I think I had seen them only in pictures, and of course they were often not tested correctly. But you're right about the coins, and one thing about the Cleopatra coins is there's two kind of versions. There's her own Alexandrian version, which she was quite pretty. And then there's the Roman ones, where she honestly looks like Antony with a wig. And there's all this speculation about why would she let herself be pictured like that? And I think, you know, one of the ideas is that, well, she didn't want to be just labeled a sex pot. And here she's showing that she looks like a soldier. And she looks every inch a man and somebody to be formidable. And anyway, why would she... surely didn't sweep Antony off his feet looking like that. But yeah, they don't look like the same person. You know, it's interesting. So what did she really look like? What did she really look like? We'll never know.
Well, of course, you went into that, Margaret, in Cleopatra. And your description of her is, I think it's very compelling.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I like to go with the Alexandrian ones, knowing, of course, that you know, she was completely in charge of what they looked like. But I don't think she would have permitted nothing could have gotten through that she didn't approve. So we know at least that she approved these. But yeah, I guess it's nice that it's up to us to imagine what she looked like. And thank heaven, I mean, both Brooke and I agree, we don't want her mummy to ever be found.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
Yeah, that's one thing we've talked about in depth, and we just want that mystery about them to be there. You know, don't ruin it. Don't disturb them. Let them rest. Yeah. They certainly deserve it.
Yeah, I would ruin, you know, the image we have. And the same thing with Alexander the Great. I mean, you know, the statues and coins will be just fine.
So what did the two of you think of Julius Caesar?
Well,
you know, I would venture to say that Margaret's Julius Caesar is slightly different than mine and her story, and I'll be interested to hearing what she has to say about that.
Well, yeah, of course, he doesn't come on the scene in my book until he meets Cleopatra, really, because things are being told from her point of view. But I, you know, it's one of those things where I just thought he was really cool. And you know, this kind of person that exudes this kind of, I don't know, aura, I think. And it's true, he could do seemingly impossible things. I mean, that's what was the most mysterious about him. You know, in the movie The Godfather, part of the aura of that was the Godfather could take care of things. You know, now, my daughter's been wronged, I'll take care of it. And you got the feeling that Caesar could kind of take care of anything. And those are mythical people to us. Of course, in the end, he couldn't. And the idea that he was going off to Parthia, he was already, you know, he was in his middle 50s. You know, was he really going to be able to sustain a campaign like that? Or was he that superhuman? You know, I think the whole idea of him as kind of more than a mortal infused my portrayal of him. At least he seemed that way to me, and he did to my Cleopatra.
And Brooke?
Well, my Caesar was portrayed pretty realistically, as far as, you know, he didn't really believe that he was a god, but he certainly wanted to be portrayed that way.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly had no problem there. You know, I think with Antony, you know, they did have a falling out at one point. So, unfortunately, that impacted my story, and I had to portray Caesar as almost an antagonist at times. And it worked well. It worked very well. I enjoyed, you know, writing it that way, and it just clicked. You know, I felt like I wrote a very realistic Julius Caesar, quite often a very brutal man, cold. He could be very cold. But he also, you know, I think especially towards the end, he was somewhat fragile in that he just was kind of, you know, becoming more human because of his medical problems, mm-hmm. you know, his falling sickness, his age, you know, I think it was all catching up on him. So it was really fun to write him. And I've been told I give good Caesar. So that was a comfort, you know.
Well,
yeah. I think, you know, he dominates scenes and dominates part of my story. At least to Cleopatra, he certainly was the dominant figure. But you're right, Brooke. You know, the physical infirmities, and I think Shakespeare called that in the Julius Caesar, where he said that about, come on my other side because I don't hear well on this one. You know, so on one hand, he's this mighty colossus that men are peeping between his legs, and then he's stomping everybody into the ground. On the other hand, he has a hearing deficiency. And I think, you know, he was aware of that. And as I said, going on that big campaign at his age, with his infirmities, I don't know. It will never know how it would have fared, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think
Parthia was a huge endeavor. And, you know, he was a very, very good planner. He was able to just piece together a campaign in so much detail, whereas, you know, Antony certainly couldn't do that. But I agree that the Parthian campaign could have finished him, you know, physically.
Yeah. He could have ended up like Crassus. I mean, wouldn't that have been a horrible ending? As it is, at least now he has this almost mythological ending, too, with the business about being stabbed at the foot of Pompey's statue and et tu, Brute, and all that. It's much better than being beheaded by the Parthians. So,
Well, it certainly played well for both of you in your writings.
Yeah.
You guys, both of you have had so much fun with your research, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Brooke got to go to some really cool places, too, Actium, and she's seen a lot of places that I didn't get to. Lucky her.
Actium made a really big impact on me because of of all the things I think I experienced at the different sites. I was floored by the enormity of the theater of war at Actium and also at Philippi. It was just so huge. You know, we're talking 20 to 50 square miles, just massive areas. Like, how did they communicate? Smoke signals? You know, what did they do? It was just really remarkable to me.
Well, of course, Margaret, you did some research in England.
Yeah. Yeah, well, England's much easier to do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a small country, and there are not all these things that are off limits, like, well, where Cleopatra's palace was, or where they thought it was, is now an Egyptian military thing, where you're not even supposed to look at it. And, you know, I just figured I didn't come all the way to Egypt to not get a picture of it, so I had to get some anyway when the guards weren't looking. But I just mean, you run into this all the time. In the Mediterranean, whereas you're not going to in England, your only problem in England is that things may not exist anymore. You know, they may Fotheringay has been leveled, or this palace has been torn down. But at least it's not, well, in Scotland, actually, the place where Mary Queen of Scots got on her little boat to run away to England against all advice was now a firing range for the British army. So you couldn't really follow that little brook all the way down to the sea there either. But that's unusual. It is much easier to do stuff in England than other places. So I really applaud Brooke, and I would have loved to go to Actium. I had to write a scene actually with Nero there because he went there too, and I had to write it about the memorial that was there, which Brooke saw, and you know, and try to imagine what it was like, you know, all those years afterwards, that they had the memorial and they had all these games they played there, you know, the Actium games. And yeah, so I think going to a place is pretty invaluable if you can manage to do it.
Now, of course,
you know, I'll add that the Octavian's War Memorial there at Actium that Margaret was just speaking of has actually the niches where the rams of Antony and Cleopatra's ships were placed, like it was some kind of award, you know, that Octavian had earned, and it was a trophy case.
Yeah.
And when you stand next to those niches, you can just imagine how huge those ships were. You know, I'm 5'6", and the niches were all 5 feet tall. They were huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, of course, Margaret, I'm glad that you mentioned Nero because I wanted to mention your two great books about Nero. First, Confessions of a Young Nero, and then Splendor Before the Dark, where you've really taken a look at Nero in a different way, brought out some fascinating parts of history that most people had never heard about. And those are your two most recent books. Wow, that was a pretty exciting thing to write two books about Nero.
Well, yeah, you know, it was supposed to be one book. Actually, if you put it together, it would be as long as Cleopatra, but it was like they had to break it into two because they didn't like a long book like that anymore. So yeah, it's really all one book. It's not two books. But, you know, it's interesting because he was had double, you know, descent from Anthony. And he had a lot of Anthony's characteristics. And he was also descended from Octavian. So he always had that heritage, that conflict of those two sides of him. Although the Anthony side was much stronger than the Augustus side. but yet it was from Augustus he got his status, you know, as a king, as an emperor. So it gave me a chance to relive a lot of my the time I had spent with Cleopatra and Antony, and also to invent, because we don't know what happened to the sons of Cleopatra and Antony. They came back to Rome, and we know the daughter married Juba II of Mauritania and became queen of Mauritania. The two boys vanished from history. And, of course, people assume they were murdered. But you really don't know, and so they could have survived. They could have just barely survived to be old enough to be still alive when Nero was a young man. And so I got the pleasure of trotting some of Anthony's descendants out on the stage again, wondering, you know, if they had gone into the army, if they just led a quiet life, you know, what was it to be Anthony and Cleopatra's child? So, you know, but Nero had all those same ties. I mean, he was not that, well, he was born in 37 A.D., and they died at, 27 or, when was it, Brooke? They lived,
it was a 30.
31, I think, maybe 30. So, you know, you've 30. Got a gap of 60 years in there. But that's not so great if you figure it's been 60 years since Kennedy was assassinated. And, you know, we still got people around that were alive then. So anyway, it was I had fun with that book. I really did, especially bringing things about Nero that the public probably doesn't know, to the popular audience. I mean, scholars know it, but the general public doesn't know. So that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that.
Yes, the general public was, you know, they were fed a lot of misconceptions about him, including, you know, standing on a balcony playing the fiddle.
Yeah. So, how many cartoons have you seen with that?
Oh, lots of
cartoons. Yeah.
I think even Bugs Bunny did it one time. They're in a toga, so they've done that over and over. So that's why it makes both books so fascinating to read as you unravel the history and do all the revealing of the things that he did, and it's really fascinating. So I really want to tell my listeners that if they need a really great read to jump into these two Nero, well, one big Nero book, The Confessions of Young Nero and Splendor Before the Dark, and they're available online. And you can also go to, Margaret, you have a wonderful webpage, and people can see all of your books there, and it's very cute. You can also see a picture of Margaret on a camel when you were about, I don't know how old.
Nine years old, yeah.
9 years old. Isn't that cute? Did you like riding a camel?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was in Egypt. You know, my father took me to Egypt. I'd become kind of obsessed with Egypt when I was young, you know, a young grade school person. And at that time, my father was in the State Department. We were stationed in Israel. And he managed to let us go to Egypt because he was in the embassy, so he could, you know, he could get a diplomatic pass to go, because at that time, Egypt and Israel, there was no communication. So he took me on this trip. It was wonderful. And that's why my father, this picture of my father is there too. And it was the times. You can see that he was wearing a coat and tie even in the desert. It's funny to think about back then that they, you know, that's just people dressed up more. But I had a wonderful time. And of course, I never really got over my infatuation with the history of ancient Egypt and Cleopatra and pharaohs and all that. So many, many years later, there came a book. Finally, as a result of this.
Well, all of your books are wonderful. I know that you have to leave and you have a luncheon to go to.
Oh, no, I'm going to be here.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, I thought you had to run. Okay, I'm so glad that you...
No, I didn't get any word. I was on a waiting list for this lunch, and I have gotten no word about it. And it's already 11:30, so, and let me check my email to see anything. So I'm here now. So now that I've taken up most of the first half, it's your turn, Brooke. Sorry, I should have told you right away.
I wanted to make sure I got you in because I thought you were going to leave me. And I wanted to make sure that we got you because, as I said, it's just, I love your book so much. It's so nice. I love being able to do a program where I don't actually, you know, I don't have to read the book in advance because I've read them. I've read your book since 1986. And of course, thank you very much. When I met you in Madison and when you were so sweet and you made me a proper British tea party and you introduced me to Brooke's writing. I remember how you pulled it out and you said, you know, I have this really great author and would I be interested? And of course that led to me eventually, talking to Brooke and having her on the program for her first one. And then, you know, this is so exciting. Now Brooke, tell us about this award, that you received first place, Antonius, Son of Rome, which is your debut novel, which is pretty great.
Well, thank you. Yes, just this past month, I received first place in the Chanticleer International Book Awards, the Chaucer division. They have different divisions, and Chaucer division starts in antiquity all the way up to about 1750. And so anyway, my book took one of the first place slots in my division, and I was just delighted. It's a very competitive award and one that apparently has a lot of impact, especially on historical novel writers. So I'm really excited. I'm blown away because that was my debut novel. So makes me feel pretty nice.
Well, you deserve it. You've done a beautiful job with the trilogy. And it's been exciting to see the development as you know, you did years of research before you actually, you know, got it all down on paper, and then they came out pretty quickly one after another.
Yeah, you know, it really does help when you're doing a trilogy or a series to have most of it written before you actually put the first book out. So it really did work well and was an advantage. And I was able to get the entire trilogy out in a year and a half. So it was a lot of work, but we did it.
Well, the award is well-deserved because it's so beautifully written. And I have a feeling that we can say that you were definitely influenced by Margaret George and her beautiful writing.
Well, you know, I need to repeat something that I shared with Margaret for the first time at the H&S conference, and that was that when I read her Cleopatra book, one of the little details that she mentioned was that when Antony's father died, he was about 11 years old. And I thought to myself, you know, if I ever wrote on Antony, I would love to start the book when his dad dies and he's faced with that impact in his life at 11 years old. And that's what happened. You know, I knew exactly where I was going to start the story. Thank you, Margaret George.
You're welcome. You're welcome. All those little, those things come to you, just some little details sometime, you know?
Yeah, they really do.
It is like magic, and how, as you're reading a book, one character just might speak to you. And this is the exciting thing, isn't it, about writing and about being a writer. And in your case, Margaret, of course, you know, you just ran with, when you started writing, and ran with an idea, not knowing that it really, I don't think that it would lead to so many books, and looking at it from the you know, like Henry's point of view, nobody had done that before. And so that's why I get so thrilled when I read great writing and pick up on individual characters sometimes like that aren't the main character, but you want to know more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it still is the only book told from his point of view. You would think that someone else would have done it. And when I started this, like, I realized that this story was always told from somebody else's point of view. And, of course, in historical novels, we were talking about this in the Historical Novel Society conference, boy, what point of view you choose is really the key thing. And I know Brooke had originally written Anthony from a first-person point of view and then was decided to shift to third, which is a different viewpoint. So, you know, I think the very fact that no one ever told from his point of view, it kind of gave me a different handle on him. I don't know why nobody else did it. For one thing, if you're going to do it from his point of view, you've got to have his whole story in it, and it's a long one.
It is.
whereas if you're doing it just from one character, like, say, Anne Boleyn or Thomas More, you don't have to have the whole kit and caboodle in there. All you have to have is a much smaller screen for that character, especially since they got executed. Their story doesn't go on as long as Henry's. So I was trying to find, you know, I had two narrators. I had two first-person narrators, and I was looking for a character that would know Henry for his whole life, preferably, and would outlive him so that he could tell what happens after Henry died. And the only one I could come up with, really, that was Will Summers, and even he didn't join Henry until Henry was about 25. So he missed out on that whole his whole childhood and the whole beginning of his reign, but he was the best, you know, parallel life I could find. But yeah, I think that's probably why that nobody else did it from his point of view. It was just it's just too big of a field.
You know, as I was reading that book, and I remember thinking, I had of course lived in England quite a few years, you know, before I read that book. I'd lived there like 5-6 years, and I had the opportunity to, well, partly because every American who came to visit me wanted, you know, a tour of you know, the palaces and things. So I had done a lot of the traveling around, going to different palaces, and so I really, you know, knew the areas. And when I was reading your book, it was like, it was such a revelation to look at it from Henry's point of view. I was so taken with it. I remember really getting chills, and I by that point I had moved. I was then living in Texas when I read the book, and I know that I said, well, there's so much more I need to see. I need to go back and look at again through Henry's eyes, and that was really very exciting.
Patsy, if I might add too. The very first book I ever read by Margaret was the autobiography of Henry VIII. And I absolutely loved the first-person aspect, but there was also one thing that I just have to share that I loved. I thought it was pure genius, and that was the notes from his Fool. Yeah. I just thought that was great.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had written a draft that didn't have that in it, and I knew it was missing something. And for some reason, if you take a long car trip for me, it's some kind of like a hypnotic thing. It's like you get into this self-hypnosis. And I'd taken this long car trip by myself to go see my grandparents. And somewhere along the road is where the idea for the second narrator came in. You know, it's like I sat and sat, what do I need to do with this? It didn't come to me until I was like, you know, driving, and after a certain number of miles, your mind sort of, I don't know, it's your subconscious or something, and kicks in. So I still get a lot of ideas if I'm in some kind of a moving vehicle for a long time. So thank you. Yeah, if it hadn't been for that trip, that long trip to see my grandparents, I might not have thought of it.
I was caught up with the idea of you visiting your grandparents. It was such a nice vision for me. People don't normally, writers don't normally talk about their grandparents. And I was just imagining the trip and wondering what they were like.
Well, my grandparents lived in Paducah, Kentucky, and they were a big influence in my life because I added up the amount of time I actually lived with them amounts to about 5 years because. My father, as I said, was in the State Department, and our official U.S. home was this my grandparents in Paducah, Kentucky. So I lived with them when my father was in the Army, and then my we lived with, and we came back from Taiwan, and I went to first grade there, and then I went to fifth grade there, and then when I was in college, my parents were overseas, and so I ended up spending time, summers with them in Kentucky. So when we were in Madison, it was exactly 500 miles straight south between Madison and Paducah, and I used to take that drive down to see them. They lived to be really old, but my grandfather made it up to 100. So, they were sort of my stability. Wonderful people, very sensible, had a lot of common sense. They always thought my writing, they almost threw away some things that I had written. I'd stored it up in their attic. And my grandmother didn't believe in throwing away things without asking, but she said, "Well, there's a lot of mess up there. I didn't know what that stuff is." I'm glad she didn't. Anyway, they were a big influence on my life. But that trip down there, as I said, it was kind of this self-hypnosis thing where you're driving along, and there's nobody else to talk to, and your mind begins to kind of create all these images and stuff. Anyway, they lived to see the Cleopatra miniseries. They lived to see the Mary Queen of Scots book, because I had to take down all this this manuscript to work on it while I was there. It was like copy editing stuff, and oh, you'll get a kick out of this. So my grandmother, I guess they thought I would write Henry and I'd get it out of my system, and they asked if I'd write another book, and I said yes. And so I was down there with this huge, it was like 800 pages, and at that point we were still editing by colored pencil and stuff. And I said to my grandmother, I said, "Well, now do you know that I really do real work?" She said, "Well, I always knew you did, but I didn't think it amounted to much." I guess she just thought it was this kind of scribbling that I did, at the desk, but it didn't amount to much, she said, with her Kentucky common sense. Anyway, so that's the story of my grandparents. I love them very much. I was named after
I think Cassie and I can both say that your writing has definitely amounted to a great deal and been so influential in so many people's careers.
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so many. Actually, if we probably counted up how many, let's say, side novels were written based on your reading your books, I'm sure that many, many, much smaller books, lesser books, followed because people were influenced by your writing and your incredible research, because you do have wonderful, wonderful bibliographies and really can point an author, I know that, some people who have written cozy mysteries say that they were influenced by, well, particularly I think Mary Queen of Scots had some sort of takeoffs of people who wrote cozy mysteries based on Mary Queen of Scots after having read that book.
Really? Oh. Well, listen, I hope my grandmother's listening here.
Well, yeah, you definitely have amounted to a lot. And because when people are doing research now, people don't, well, as you said, they're not writing the books the length that you write today. And the truth is, it's, although research is, you actually read a lot of books.
I did read a lot of books. Yeah. Back then, and nothing was online. So I bought all these books. I still have them. They're still in the shelves. And if they were in a library, I would always try to get some kind of a used copy. So I had it myself, and I could, I could make notes on it and put sticky notes on it and everything. I didn't have to have a timeline when I had to return them.
Well, because by having to read the books, I think that's why your writing is so good, because there's depth to it. And I know that many, many, there are many novels that have been written about both, particularly Mary Queen of Scots, I think, a lot. Of course, Henry and all the you know, wives. And I have a feeling a lot of authors have really lent, you know, they've taken things from your writing as a sort of guidepost where to go and what to look at. And because I don't think there are a lot of writers today who actually read as much because, you know, it's too easy to, you know, click on the computer and get sort of the gist of things.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, you know, it's ironic because I thought we needed a bibliography and an author's afterword for Henry, and my editor at the time said, no, this is a novelist fiction. We don't put that in fiction books. But by the time a paperback came out, it was clear that you needed it. And so it's in the paperback. It's not in the hardcover. And and all the other books, of course, have the bibliographies in them. And I think now a lot of fiction things have the bibliographies because people want to know where they get it.
You know, I always include a bibliography on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And as it develops, I just add to it.
Yeah, that's true. It's not static like that. Yeah, true.
Well, and that's the nice thing about the computer age is, you know, you can do that in real time, which is great. So
that's true. Yeah, it evolved. So, yeah, so mine is kind of static because, and of course, I can't add any books that were written after I did the books because they didn't influence me. So I can't say, you know, I relied on this book or this book was really helpful or anything. I don't know. I think people, I've read some books, I hate to say this, because it's, you know, it's my age. Well, they're writing books that were actually in the era that I've lived. So, I mean, when they start writing, you know, historical novels, historical in quotes, about stuff in the 1960s, even the 50s, and of course they make a lot of mistakes because there are things that you couldn't actually research because it probably wouldn't even be in there. But, and I wonder, you know, with us, how many mistakes do we make? Because the things that we look up, they wouldn't have perhaps ever been recorded. We would like to know, but we don't know because we only know what was recorded. And that really, you realize if you've lived in the time, you know how much is missing that someone could possibly in doing research. For example, the popularity, I'll give you a real example here. The popularity of girls' names is especially volatile, and it changes in every decade. And so someone writing about something in the 1950s was using names that we didn't use in the 1950s. You know, they were not popular names. Maybe an occasional person, 1 in 10,000, might have been named that. But, you know, there were no Ashleys, and there were no, you know, the kind of things that are now popular, and they didn't take that into account when they wrote this book. But I suppose if you were absolutely diligent, you'd go back in all those census things and see, you know, which were the most popular names and so on. But you can't check on everything because now there's so much document. So for the things that Brooke and I were working, we were probably blessed that there wasn't every single thing that we have now. I think it would be a great challenge to write a novel.
You really would.
Beyond a certain time, the amount of documentation you would have to go through so that there wouldn't be somebody like me saying, well, they didn't have that name yet. You know, you'd find a million things like that. And I'm not criticizing the author because nobody's that superhuman. They can't do it, but it's a terrible task, I think, a real challenge to anybody now. So people say, why do you write about people that have been dead at least 500 years?
I can give a great example of what Margaret's talking about, because I've gone from ancient Rome, and my new project is at the beginning of the 19th century. And so there's so much more documentation. So much more I have to be careful of. There are letters, you know, there are court documents. And I've had this, you know, go back and check things and second check things.
So what are you working on?
I haven't missed some date or some obscure reference to something that I'm writing on. I just have to be really a lot more careful.
What's the new subject?
Oh, the new subject is actually what took place after the Lewis and Clark expedition. And my point of view character is Julia Hancock Clark, who was the first wife of William Clark. So,
wow, that sounds exciting.
It is. It's really been a different animal and a lot of fun to research. In fact, I'm going in 2 weeks to St. Louis for a little trip, research trip, to the Missouri Historical Society Museum, and I'm going to be able to see things like William Clark elk skin journal that he carried with him on the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's going to be fabulous. I can't wait.
Yeah, that's so exciting. I'm so happy for you.
Research is so much fun. I don't think people realize it, but it's such a treat to do research. You know, knowledge is never wasted, and we authors just have such a fabulous opportunity to learn and to give, you know, posterity a little bit of something that happened 150, 200 years ago, 2,000 years ago, what have you, so that they have it with them.
Well, the research is fun, and the writing is fun, and even the editing can be fun. But
But
what's not so fun is having to mark it, I think. And that's why, you know, I like to have, that's why I do Joy on Paper, to give authors the opportunity to remind listeners about their books. And that's why I wanted both of you on, because I think all of my listeners, my regular listeners, know about you because I promo your books at odd times of the year, in between other books, because I want people to read your books. So, Margaret, you have a website. It's Margaret George, real easy to remember. Everyone, you can go to that website and you can see all of Margaret's books and you can order them right there. You can click on them. Anything else special you want to say? I know that you were running a promo. I don't know if you have a promo going now for any of your books.
The Confessions of Young Nero is going to be on sale, the Kindle version, for $1.99 sometime in July. And I keep, in fact, while we're here, I'll look it up. And I keep looking every day to see if they come down and then I can announce it. But so far, it hasn't. Oh, it has. It has today. It is. It's on $1.99.
Oh, my goodness. People, this is a tremendous opportunity for you to jump in and get this book. So it's available online today.
Listen, thank you for reminding me, because, you know, they hadn't told me. They said just watch the sites and see when it goes on sale. So last night it was still $14.99. And this morning, right here, it's $1.99. So I will announce it on the website and on my Facebook and everything, but thank you for thinking of it.
Okay, well, and I will remind my listeners, too, because this is a wonderful opportunity for you, for them to get your book, and just to, once they read one of your books, they're hooked on you. And then,
well, thank you.
Brooke, what about you? You have your website, which is what?
It is brookeallenauthor.com, and I will also say that my first debut novel that just won the award is on sale for, the Kindle version is on sale for 99 cents right now, and will be for at least another week. So,
wow. Okay, everybody. Well, that's so good. See, I had you on, I had both of you on at the exact right time where you have.
You sure did. Wow, we're having a big sale here.
Well, this worked out. This worked out perfectly, because that's one of the things that gives me joy, is to help authors promote their books, because books come out and sometimes you only have a short window of opportunity to do the promotion. But that's my job, is to help you promote at for years to come. Okay.
Thank you. We're very grateful to you.
We certainly are.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to both of you. Thank you so much for joining me on Joy on Paper today. You know that I love you both. And Margaret, I think of you always. Now you're in Washington, D.C., but of course my trip to Madison was one of the highlights of my life, especially my Joy on Paper life, getting to meet you, and that you made me a lovely, really lovely English tea with salmon sandwiches. It was a joy.
Well, thank you. No, I hope we meet again, and I look forward to that. And, yeah, it was great to meet you and your son. And, yeah, we'll meet again. We'll meet again.
Yeah, the three of us have to get together.
Yeah.
And
that would be awesome.
Have another proper English tea party.
Yeah.
Okay?
Or a toga party.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was head of my Latin club. I was the president of my Latin club, SPQR. So, yeah. I love that idea. Okay. Thank you both for joining me today. It's been a pure joy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patsy.
For us, too.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Wow. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, they are so wonderful. Wow. This has been a thrill for me today to talk to both of them. As you heard, both of them have sales going on their books, and this is a wonderful opportunity to grab the books, read them, and then once you read one, you'll want to read all of them, but make sure that you put a review on Amazon for them, because those reviews are very important. Also, pre-orders are very important. So if you really want to do something nice for an author, you can always pre-order their book. And I tell you that Amazon really, takes notice of that. And so one of the books that you can pre-order is Be My Ghost, which is Carol J. Perry's book one in her new series, Haunted Haven. And that series is set right here in our area, here in Florida. So we're going to get a lot of fun references to our area. And it is available for pre-order. And you can do that. And also, Rita Moreau has a book coming out. And as you know, she is our book buzz maven. She's one take Rita, and she has a book coming out in August, and it's called Murder on Honky Tonk Row, and you can pre-order that. So really, pre-orders are fantastic. It's like giving a gift. You might as if you wanted to box something up and tie it with a red ribbon, pre-ordering is a gift, because Amazon will just rate them higher, put them higher on the list. And it makes a big, big difference. So please pre-order both of them, Carol J. Perry and Rita Moreau. And it's a wonderful thing to do. It's like in Yiddish we say a little mitzvah, a little favor, a little gift that you give, a good deed. And it's a wonderful thing to do. So anyway, it's been a great day to talk to both Brooke Allen and Margaret George. They are fantastic authors. You just all wish that you could write like them someday, for all of you who are just starting off. Because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't unless you start writing. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye-bye, everyone. Have a great day.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kaifen. Price pain in a pandemic.
The cost of produce, the cost of meat, deli, things that are prepared have gotten more expensive now.
And it's not just the supermarket. The government says consumer prices in June shot up nearly a full percentage point over the past year. Prices are up 5.4%, the most since 2008. Business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
There's pent-up demand because people...